I know many of you have been here for a while, but I see a few new faces in the audience, so I'll just introduce myself again. I'm Christopher Manfredi, Dean of the Faculty of Arts at McGill University, and I'm delighted to be able to welcome everyone to this first ever Kundal Lecture in History at McGill University. This is a lecture that comes out of the generosity and vision of Mr. Peter Kundal, who created a wonderful prize, International Book Prize for History, accompanied that with some funding for graduate students in the Department of History at McGill University. And as a result of this prize, we were able to invite this year for the first time the previous year's winner to come and give a lecture as part of our program in awarding the prize. So you've just sat through the announcement of Lisa Jardine as the winner of this year's Kundal Prize, which means that Professor Jardine will be with us next year. But I'm delighted, I would be delighted to introduce this year's lecture, but that honor is going to go to someone else. So my job is to introduce the introducer. So I'd like to ask Professor Davkin Studnicki Gisbert to come up and introduce this year's Kundal Lecture, last year's winner of the Kundal Prize. So if I'd ask Professor Davkin Studnicki Gisbert to come up and introduce our lecture.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thank you, Paul. It's kind of an honor to be able to do this. Stuart B. Schwartz is George Burton Adams Professor of History at Yale University, former Master of Urza Styles College at Yale, Comendador of Brazil's Order of the Southern Cross, and now first winner of the Kundal International Prize in History for his book, All Can Be Saved, Religious Tolerance and Salvation in the Iberian Atlantic World. Stuart is a native of Springfield, Massachusetts. He did his undergraduate degree down the road at Middlebury College and obtained his PhD in 1968 under the mentorship of Stanley Stein and Louis Henke. He quickly became one of the leading American historians of Brazil, publishing a series of landmark studies about its past. These treated such themes as the establishment and workings of the institutions of colonial justice and government, the social and economic history of the Brazilian plantation system, as well as the responses of enslaved Africans and Afro-Brazilians to the dominant slaveholding society. But while Brazil, I think, will always have a special place in Stuart's heart and his concerns, you ought to know that he's a singularly wide-ranging scholar. And here's a short sample of what else he's been working on. Hurricanes in Puerto Rico, race in colonial Mexico, historical demography, theater and court politics in mid-17th century Spain and Portugal, the beginnings of the sugar industry in the Caribbean, the comparative history of cities in the early Americas, and the problem of cross-cultural encounters in the period of European expansion across the globe. He has served as co-editor of the Cambridge History of Native Americans, these are the South American volumes, and is the author of at least a few textbooks on the Spanish conquest of Mexico, the colonial period of Latin American history, and on world history. This latest book on popular tolerance in the Iberian world is a return of sorts. You see, Louis Henke, who was Stuart's mentor back in Colombia, was a specialist on the life and the work of Bartolomé de las Casas, a Dominican who used a combination of history telling, theology, and straight-up politicking to seek justice for the indigenous Americans facing the onslaught of European disease and conquest. Working on on Frei de las Casas allowed Henke to explore some of the key problems in modern history, the development of a universalistic conception of humanity, the meaning of justice in a context of conquest and resistance, the acceptance or rejection of cultural diversity. All this was being played out in the 16th century, but of course, the matter of how it was worked out is of critical importance to us. Well, the acorn never falls too far from the tree. All Can Be Saved, Stuart's book, engages these same issues of justice and cultural religious difference. But it does so in a surprising and exciting way. Whereas Henke worked on the learned elites of early modern Iberian world, Stuart recovers for our consideration a much more humble group of individuals who believed strongly in the ideal of religious tolerance. Stuart calls them rustic Pelagians, after Pelagius, who in the 4th century argued that all humans could save themselves through good acts. In the early modern period, this argument had morphed into the idea that people simply needed to do right in order to be saved, even those considered outside the pale by church and state. That is, Muslims, Jews, Protestants, Native Americans, Africans, and the myriad other, quote, pagans that Europeans were encountering throughout the world. Why would God condemn good people simply because they had been born Jewish, Muslim, or pagan? Where was the justice in that? The people expressing these ideas were masons and carpenters, peasants and mariners, men and women, young and old. And they considered themselves to be good Christians, but they were concerned about the fate of their neighbors, of those held in bondage or in subordination. And they were strongly committed to these ideas, holding them even in the context of inquisitorial prosecution, not an easy position to argue from. In fact, as Stuart shows, popular tolerance provided a wellspring for a more pointed attack on the institutions themselves, institutions like the Inquisition. Well, the more I read, the more I sympathized. Hey, I guess I'm a Pelagian too. And this, I think, is what is important about Stuart's book. The commitment to tolerance was not peculiar to our supposedly modern times, nor was it limited to a few heroes. It was something much deeper and broader, and it was something that the institutions of church and state sought to repress for centuries. In closing, I would just like to add my recognition to the smart and good work done by the Cunthill Prize Committee by picking out this book. It helps us all better appreciate the longer history of tolerance, a useful perspective in our often heated debates about cultural accommodation these days. And also, since last year, the book has gone on to win 4 of the major prizes awarded by the historical profession, the Bolton, the Fagg, the Gershoy, and the Mosse. It's as close to a clean sweep as any book in history has ever come. The Cunthill people obviously knew a great thing when they saw it. And now you can hear it for yourselves directly from Stuart B. Schwartz.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to return here to Montreal and to present the first Cunthill lecture. And I want to thank Eamon Frady, the prize committee, Mr. Cunthill for sure, and the McGill Department of History for all their efforts to establish this prize and this program in history. Of course, I owe a special debt of thanks to Dabakan Studnicki-Gisbert, who was my former graduate student, came to work with me at Minnesota and moved with me to Yale and has now returned to his native Montreal and to be a member of the faculty here at McGill. Dabakan was one of those students who you knew right from the beginning was going to teach you more than you were ever going to teach him. And so it's a special pleasure to return here to McGill to be in with him in this company and to have him introduce me. Well, this last year, since the receipt of the first Cunthill Prize, has been very special for me. And one of the most pleasant moments of my nomination to the short list last year and the invitation to the ceremony here in Montreal was the opportunity to make the acquaintance of Peter Fritchie and Michael Cook, the other two nominees on the shortlist last year. At last year's meeting, I had the chance to listen to them and to discuss with them the writing of history and to learn about their work. And subsequently, I had the opportunity to read their wonderful books. It was clear I had been in extraordinary company. And as I read Peter Fritchie's book, Life and Death in the Third Reich, it struck me that his book and mine had really been about the moral and ethical decisions of a society and of individuals in that society. In his case, Germany around the time of the Second World War, and in mine, Spain and Portugal during the epoch of the Inquisition. In quite different ways, both of our books asked a similar question. What do people do when social, political, religious, and economic or other forces call for support or conformity in the implementation of brutal and unjust policies? Fritchie's book was essentially an extended condemnation of complicity, an analysis of moral and ethical collapse and failure in the lead-up to the Second World War and through it. My book was a description, and I would admit a celebration, of those who were willing to question policies of the state or the predominant theology of the church. But both of these books were each in their own way about the possibility of individual action and its implications for history. This year in the United States, the National History Day, which is run through Washington for high school students, was on the theme of the individual and history. And so it seemed to me that really what I had been doing was something that concerned many people. We historians have long been concerned with the question of individual action. Much of social science literature for the last century has essentially been about the study of the transition from community or group identity and action to individualism, a transition that supposedly took place with modernity. How and why that process took place, how people began to think of themselves as individuals rather than as members of a group or some collective or corporate entity, has fascinated thinkers from Hegel and Marx to Max Weber and J.G. Polkow. Moreover, historians have also raised the question of individual action or genius as a power in shaping the past. Was Napoleon a product of his time, or was he, by the force of his will and character, the maker of history? What matters most, the deep structures of historical forces, a la Braudel, or the contingencies of individual historical decisions and action made by the makers of history? For the famous English historian Thomas Carlyle, it was the great historical figures, always men, of course, that merited our attention. But what about the rest of us? Not the great shapers of history, the Napoleons and Caesars or Spinozas and Socrates, but the common folk. What Peter Kundal said to me in a letter I received a few months ago, the Piers Plowman of the past. What about their decisions and their actions? Do those contribute to the course of history? And if they do, how can we as historians recapture them? Well, in the glow of following the award of the Kundal Prize, and in the preparation of the Spanish and Portuguese translations of my book this year, I had the opportunity to reconsider my book and the evidence in it of individual thought and action, the action of common people, as a motive force in history. In a way, that was the underlying theme of my book. And what I want to do today is to discuss some of the curious individuals and ideas that populate the pages of that book to see what their lives and thoughts might suggest about the place of individual human actions in the past, their culminative effect, and how we as historians can write about them. So let me start with a strange and enigmatic character. In 1701, the Inquisition of Murcia in southeastern Spain arrested a man named Inocencio de Aldama. I'm sure you've never heard of him. He was tall, 28 years old, light complexion, short brown hair, and an aquiline nose. He was of old Christian stock, that is, there were no converts in his family tree, and he was a native of the Basque country. In November of 1701, he had been admitted to a hospital, and there he entered into conversations with the resident caretaker about the life that he was living. Aldama had apparently wanted at some point to be a priest, but he said God had not willed it, and so he was living the life of the road with no fixed residence and no profession, despite the fact that he could read and write. He was, he said, a man who God had destined to be a vagabond and condemned to a life of tribulations. The resident was critical and told him that it was God's will that he apply himself to an honest trade, proportionate to his salvation. When the conversation turned to salvation, Aldama had said, "Any person can save themselves in the law, the religion that they profess, so long as they follow it, be they Muslim, infidel, or heretic. And we all come from the same trunk from which different branches appear, and all of these branches bear fruit. And so too with all the religions, all of them bear fruit. And all can be saved in the religion that they wish to believe so long as they keep it responsibly. The resident found such ideas to be schismatic and denounced Aldama, who was then arrested by the Inquisition. Corroborating witnesses were called to testify, and his remarks were submitted to three churchmen to be evaluated. All three found his statements to be formal heresies. Further sessions followed, in which Aldama claimed that God had taken from him his free will for not continuing his studies, and on the issue of salvation, however, the best the inquisitors could do was to have Aldama say that he did not know if those who were not Christians could actually be saved. Aldama was assigned a court lawyer for his defense, and under that advice, the defendant swore that he believed in all the church taught, but on the nature of his statements began to become cloudy and obscure. By February, the tribunal staff had become convinced that Aldama was mad, and he was getting worse. A physician was brought to by the court. He came to the same conclusion. And by April, the lawyer was asking that the case be dismissed and Aldama be released. But the madness was problematic because sometimes he spoke and thought very clearly. Try as they might, the inquisitors could not dissuade him from some things. He told them, each person has his own orientation, and from this belief, not even the doctors of Salamanca could ever convince or dissuade him. So how do you deal with a case like this? How to explain these strange ideas? The investigation continued. Testimony was gathered from across Spain. Aldama had apparently lived with his maternal grandmother and his uncle, a priest, and at some point he had been disrespectful, and fearing his uncle, he had fled to Madrid, and there was pressed into service as a soldier. He had campaigned in Catalonia, in Sicily, and Naples before he returned to Madrid. Relatives had sought to send him back to the Basque Country, but he had refused, and they came to see him as melancholy, often talking to himself. His discussion with the inquisitors led to further confusion and consultation, and the result was a vote to place him under observation in a hospital for the mad in Valencia. How should we view Aldama? Was the melancholy like that of Hamlet, feigned and real at the same time, a kind of strategy for survival? The Spanish historian Juan Blasquez Miguel has argued that rather than being mad, Aldama was a man of great culture, brilliant intelligence, and sharp reasoning, who tried to convince the inquisitors of his position. He seems to have been in many ways a man who had been battered by life and had withdrawn into himself, but also a man who had traveled widely, had lived abroad, had mixed in with his strange ideas, was a truth that he tenaciously defended and that was shared, in fact, by others, that each person could save themselves in their own religion, and that all the religions sprang from the same tree and all of them bore fruit, and that each person had his own destiny to fulfill. On these points, not even the doctors of Salamanca could dissuade him. Now, a life story like this is always a construction, a self-representation made in this case under threat, as well as what it was the product of the testimony gathered by the inquisitors themselves. But despite artifice and obfuscation, there are patterns that suggest commonalities here. There were many people like Aldama who expressed religious tolerance or relativism, people who had traveled and seen the world, or who were open to ideas through their access to books. Undoubtedly, travel broadened, and it's tempting to see these people as part of a kind of subculture of difference, people who were often marginal in occupation or status, prone to change, more mobile than their peers, and somehow intrinsically more open to different ideas, ideas different than the vast majority. But such a reading is too facile. It suggests a contrast with an immobile rural society which the travelers had left. But that contrast is no longer easy to sustain. Tens of thousands of rural people in modern times moved along the highways and roads each year as part of the harvest cycles. Thousands of others marched off to Flanders or France or Italy or Catalonia or Portugal in the armies of the king. Thousands of others made their way from villages and towns to the seaports to serve in the fleets or to in the world of maritime commerce. And there was, of course, a constant stream of immigrants that flowed from these small villages and towns across the Atlantic to America. For those who left, undoubtedly travel and experience had the potential to open new minds to new ideas, but not necessarily. Many a sojourner was denounced by his traveling companions or his shipmates. There seems to be no set of social characteristics that place those who developed the ideas of tolerance or relativism apart from their more orthodox peers. Every person was a potential traveler, every traveler a potential heterodox thinker. But many who took to the road or the sea remained entirely orthodox in their beliefs. Individual decisions and convictions, rather than social characteristics or life experiences, seem to determine what path of belief they took. I was surprised to find many people like Aldama in the world of early modern Spain and Portugal, countries that are usually put forward as the models of intolerant, persecuting societies. The expulsion of the Jews, the Muslims, and eventually the subsequent discrimination against the converts from those faiths seemed to make the Iberian kingdoms and their overseas empires the models of intolerance. While other empires, the Roman, the Mughal, the Ottoman, the Qing, developed strategies of religious inclusion, the Iberian empires made religious unity the sine qua non of citizenship, the key to state power. The guiding principle of empire was framed in the words of the poet Hernando de Acuña, "One flock, one pastor, one king, one empire, one faith." Unity and orthodoxy became the essential objectives of a state, and those objectives upheld by the church, and especially by the tribunals of the Inquisition. No one was allowed to question that unity openly. And when, in the 1780s, some began to do so publicly, the Inquisition responded sharply with these words: "Intolerance is the fundamental law of the Spanish nation. It was not created by the common people, and they should not be the ones to end it." So despite the overwhelming evidence of religious intolerance and the marginalization of converts from the other faiths from the 15th century forward, there's also considerable evidence of a certain kind of religious relativism and skepticism, the kind expressed by a person like Aldama. "Each person can be saved in their own law" was a common refrain. The phrase was repeated with slight variation by men and women of many backgrounds, illiterate laborers and peasants, soldiers, mariners, merchants, and even some clergymen from time to time, usually Franciscans. It was heard in the mouths of converts anxious to defend their former faith, but also from old Christians who dissented from the church's dogmatic position, which was nulla salus extra ecclesiam. There is no salvation outside the church. For those dissenters, religion and theology, religion and law, or theology and ethics were conflated. They saw them as the same thing. Belief and ethics were one, and they held that anyone who lived according to natural law or held to God's precepts in another religion would also be saved. This was a kind of permissive theory of salvation that had the effect of neither condemning nor demonizing the other. And as such, it undermined a considerable program of the state and church to assure unity throughout orthodoxy. Many people believed God loves us all. Others were religious relativists who thought there might be many paths to truth. And others were pragmatists, like a convert from Islam named Gaspar Vallesan, who told the inquisitors in 1567 that he, in fact, believed in all three religions: the religion of our Lord Jesus Christ, the religion of Muhammad, and the religion of Mr. Moses, because he said, "If one of them lets me down, I'll always be able to fall back on the others." A very practical kind of soteriology. Some of these people were convinced Catholics who felt that discrimination and force in matters of conscience was uncharitable and against Christ's teachings. Why, asked Andre Lopez, a Portuguese old Christian, did the inquisitors wish to make the conversos, the converts, Christians by force if God didn't want them to be Christians in the first place? and there were still others for whom no religion was valid. There was only birth and death. Such skepticism was not necessarily born of only philosophical doubt. One convert from Islam, on his way to market, was asked which of the religions he thought was best, and he said he had no time, he had no law, no religion in his heart, because he was too poor to permit himself such a luxury. That is, he couldn't concern himself with these issues. He was too busy finding something to eat. This idea that all could be saved was considered by the church a proposition, a doubt about dogma that was potentially heretical and as such in need of correction. The sources for such ideas about the validity of all faiths were varied. Converts from Islam, what were called Moriscos, were thought particularly prone to this idea. There were, in fact, in Islam, concepts like fitra, or innate human religiosity that was molded only accidentally by the accident of birth. That is, you became what your parents made you become. Our parents determine our religion. And there were Quranic passages that could be interpreted in this way, such as Quran 5:59. To each of you, God has prescribed a law and a way. If God had willed, he would have made you a single people. But God's purpose is to test you in what he has given each of you. So strive for the pursuit of all virtues and know that you will all return to God. Moriscos could take or mold such concepts to their resentment under the pressures of conversion. One Morisco expressed his frustration of the expression of many when he complained that God really hadn't done his job very well, making some of us Christians, some of us Muslims, and some of us Jews, and if he wanted us all to be of one faith, he should have made us so from the beginning. Converts, conversos from Judaism, also held the idea that the old law, the law of Moses, had been a good one and had remained valid even after their conversion. While adopting Christian concepts of salvation foreign to Judaism, they continued to emphasize the validity of their former faith. Other converts adopted a relative disposition that all the faiths were made by God and thus all were valid. And some of the converts, like Spinoza, came to have doubts about the validity of any religion. But such skepticism was not limited to only converts. Whatever the rationale for universalist, relativist, or skeptical ideas about religious minorities, these ideas were also broadly shared by the old Christian community. There was a medieval theological tradition in which the validity of natural law, perfect ignorance, that is, never having the real faith, true faith revealed, and the possibility of salvation outside the church had long been debated. Although St. Thomas Aquinas' position that the church was the universal path that alone could lead to liberation of the soul had by the 14th century triumphed, it had to be reconciled with a concept of salvation available to all mankind. And so a series of apologetic arguments developed, founded on the idea that God could be recognized by natural theology and human reason. Dawkins mentioned Pelagius or the theologian Origen from the 3rd century, who believed that eventually a merciful God was going to save everybody. But the position of Pelagius and Origen was eventually condemned as heretical, and it was the position of St. Thomas that predominated. But the doubts never went away amongst the theologians themselves. And even if you look at Dante's poem of Paradise, there's a verse in it that says, "What justice is there in condemning the blameless infidel who lives on the banks of the Ganges, right, to suffer eternal damnation if he has lived a good life? What fault was it of his?" The theologians had not made the issue disappear. But theological debate and questioning was not the only cause for doubt. Iberia, Spain, and Portugal's peculiar multi-religious cultural traditions of recognition and an uneasy accommodation also made their contribution. Whatever the relationship between the three religions had become by the 15th century, which was usually hostile, on the personal level, there had been constant interaction between individuals and families and communities, a kind of live and let live that sometimes had led to feelings of cultural relativity and admiration. A cloth merchant from Merchant, in a discussion about bad weather and shortages in Spain, said to his neighbor that God sent good weather and abundance to the Muslims in North Africa and to the pagans because they live better in their religion than we live in ours, adding that they love and care for each other while all we wish to do is hurt each other. And if we loved each other as they do and kept God's law, he would provide us his mercy. There were Castilians who objected to the expulsion of the Jews in 1492 and to the war against the Muslims of Granada. How do you expect it to rain, said one drought-stricken farmer from Soria, when the king is going to take the Moors' homes away from them and they haven't ever done him any harm? And in Portugal, voices were raised against the king's crusade in North Africa in 1578. As one person said, only God knows if this war is just or unjust because the Muslims are also his creatures. Sometimes these expressions of sympathy were bravely spoken and deeply felt. There were persons who were willing to speak out against what they perceived to be policies that were misguided or against God's intentions or the principles of Christian charity. Fernando de Lucena, a public scribe from the Balearic Islands, from Mallorca, told some friends during a discussion of some people who had been tried by the Inquisition of Toledo that the good Moor should die as a Moor, that is, the Muslim as a Muslim, the Jew as a Jew, and the Christian as a Christian. And when somebody lamented that those condemned for still practicing Judaism had stubbornly rejected the cross up to the very end, Lucena defended them and said that they had not abandoned their faith and they had died like good soldiers, never taking a backward step. Here was undisguised admiration for constancy of belief. For this, he was denounced by his friends. The idea that Jews dying for their faith were martyrs like the Christians who had died for theirs was expressed from time to time, not only by converts, but by Christians, old Christians. A Portuguese musician told the inquisitors in the 1620s that he didn't attend an auto de fe, that is a public punishment of the heretics, because he knew that when St. Barbara had been martyred by the Romans, that there had been thunderbolts and lightning in the heavens, and since it was raining that day, he refused to attend the punishment of the Judaizers, the Jews, because he was afraid that God would also send thunderbolts and lightning from heaven. Another man, arguing with his neighbors who thought the Jews condemned to death should have saved themselves by accepting the cross, said, "Be quiet. You don't understand anything about this. How do you know they're going to hell? Each person needs to look after himself. These people and all those who die in this way die innocent and without guilt." And a famous case of a woman who was a convert from Judaism, who was married to an old Christian in Mexico City, she, when arrested, told the inquisitors that she had said that God the Father is never angry at those who believe in God the Son, and those who believe in God the Son shouldn't be angry with those who believe in God the Father. A very rational statement, it seems. Now, there were some segments of the population that were particularly prone to this kind of thinking. Renegades, former captives in North Africa. There were many, of course, in the Mediterranean world and English too, who ended up as captives for a while in North Africa. These people were enslaved, but nevertheless, they lived in another culture for a long period of time. And when they came back, they often had a kind of cultural sensitivity. So they'd be in a tavern somewhere and somebody would denounce the Muslims and they'd say, "Well, you know, they're really very charitable." Or they pray five times a day. They have their holy men too. So they had developed a certain kind of cultural relativity out of their experience. And these ideas were not limited to Spaniards and Portuguese, because there were many people arrested by the Spanish Inquisition. Flemings, Italians, Greeks, and especially the French, who also made such statements about the relativity of religious salvation and religious belief. The French merited special concern because it was thought that they might be what the Spanish call Lutherans, Protestants. For example, a French farmer from Toulouse got in an argument with friends who asked about how it could be possible, and he said, "How could it be possible that all those Protestant dukes and counts and doctors and ladies in France were all condemned to hell?" He just simply couldn't believe that. And when told that they were damned, he gave the response, "What do you know about who will be damned or saved? only God really knows. The presence of these ideas amongst foreigners undercuts this idea that this is somehow a peculiar result of the three religions living together in Spain in the Middle Ages. No, I think this idea can be found beneath the surface in many places across Europe at the time. Well, in the face of all these ideas, these dissident ideas, the position of the Inquisition was firm. There was only one true faith. All others are false, and all other religions are merely sects. Salvation is only possible through baptism within the church. This message was broadcast widely, but it encountered stubborn, persistent, practical, and permissive resistance, sometimes based on a reading, or sometimes misreading, of Scripture that allowed for the salvation of all mankind. This resistance was not organized or coordinated. It was instead the result of individuals questioning, thinking, trying to resolve what seemed to them to be a contradiction within the faith. The inquisitors responded subtly. Defending propositions were sometimes considered heretical, but not always. Punishments of uneducated offenders tended to be lenient, fines and penance, and sometimes exile or whippings. But clergy and literate offenders, as well as converts, were much more likely to be accused of heresy and treated more harshly. But despite the fact that prosecutions for propositions decreased after the mid-17th century, these ideas lingered on. And it's possible to characterize those who believed in salvation for all, or at least were willing to concede that only God knew who would be saved. The idea was found amongst converts and old Christians. It was not limited to Spaniards and Portuguese, and a significant number of foreigners are also present. Many of these people who appear in the trials, it's interesting, could read and write, but had not gone to university. That is, they'd never had any formal theological training. And what they wanted most of all was the opportunity to read for themselves the Scripture, or to read books on their own, and to be able to come to their own conclusions. Travel and cosmopolitanism itself did not explain doubts about dogma or willingness to speak out. Many people, in fact, were not peasants or laborers, but were tradesmen and people from the middling sectors. But they did have this desire to think on their own. Finally, it should be emphasized that prior to 1750, these people did not represent a party or a movement. They were individuals who simply shared this common proposition. And as such, their threat to establish order would seem small. It would seem an exaggeration to think of these people in terms of what you might call individualism, a doctrine or an ideological position. Many of these people would have thought that they were, in fact, expressing the true principles of faith of their community. That is, that they were not breaking away from their faith. These people were bringing their inner world of doubt, of thoughts, and questions into the realm of a larger society in which they lived. That act of allowing the individual self to contest community standards is, as historian John Martin has suggested, the Renaissance creation of the individual as a protagonist in history, a role that need not be restricted to humanists, artists, and philosophers. That is, we think about the rise of individualism as somehow the product of great thinkers, of Michelangelo or Shakespeare, as is sometimes written. But what we're finding in this documentation that comes from the Inquisition is that these ideas were part of a milieu that existed in which those great thinkers and remarkable individuals existed, but so too did lots of other people. And so the Inquisition was, in fact, right to fear them. They could see that the step from freedom of conscience to other kinds of freedom could be a short one. And the fact that often these dissidents wanted to make up their own minds about the meaning of Scripture, about God's intentions, about the nature of sin, and what seemed to them to be just, was a potential danger to authority. And nowhere did that become clearer than in the New World. America presented various kinds of eschatological hopes and challenges to orthodoxy. The conversion of the pagan peoples of America became the acknowledged task of both the crown and the altar. Various authors saw the availability of millions of new adherents to the church through the conversion of the Indians. Compensation for what had been lost to the church in Europe. The fact that Cortez and Martin Luther were born in the same year was never lost on the observers. And they would point it out that what the devil had taken away from the church in Europe, God would return to the church in America by the agency of people like Cortez. But the size of America, its myriad pagan inhabitants, its conditions, its distance from the centers of authority, also created threats to that hope, millenarian hope. The policy of intolerance and religious unity were strictly applied to the New World in the Spanish and Portuguese empires. Restrictions on immigration began quite early, and a whole system of passports and registry was constructed to regulate and prohibit the passage of heretical ideas and people to America. But such propositions were always evaded. Such prohibitions were always evaded. Converts from Judaism or Islam, or foreigners who might be Protestants, presented a threat to the orthodoxy of the empire, especially in an environment where the faith was still new amongst the indigenous peoples. Thus, for political and economic reasons, but always with a religious motive as well, punishments of foreigners were always stern in the Spanish Empire. But America also presented a more serious threat, the challenges of what was called liberty, by which was meant the lack of restraint, sexual and moral license, freedom from the obligations of dependency and rank, freedom from taxes, and sometimes, by implication, freedom of conscience. As early as 1516, Father Las Casas had called for the establishment of an Inquisition in America because of the threat of liberty. And in the 18th century, Jesuits in the Rio de la Plata argued that not one, but two or three Inquisition tribunals might be necessary in that region if Spain did not want in its dominions that each person live in the law that they wanted to live, that is, in the religion that they wanted. The possibility of linking Christian free will with freedom of conscience, that is, with religious freedom, was an inherent theological and philosophical problem. That is, as individuals, we were supposed to have free will. But if you have this free will, then it should be your free will to decide what your religion is to be. So why should the state or the church be involved in forcing that? It was an inherent contradiction for the theologians, and an inherent contradiction that common people understood. So, a major challenge to authority came from various areas. While there were many who exploited the indigenous peoples and believed they had no souls to be saved, there were others for whom the traditional attitudes about the monotheistic religions in the Mediterranean were now extended to other peoples and other beliefs. A Spanish woman from Cuzco, for example, told her friends that before the Spaniards came to Peru, the Indians also could go to heaven. And another man, Francisco de Escobar, a Peruvian mestizo of the first generation, a Métis, inherited his father's estate, and he lived an unrestrained life amongst the Indians, the Indian dependents on that estate, often sleeping with the women, and sometimes reading to the Indians and to the slaves on the estate from the books of Amadís de Gaula, the books of chivalry that were the popular reading of the time. And when in 1586 his neighbors complained that he did not allow his Indians to go to Mass and he needed to care for their salvation, he answered them, "Shut up, leave the Indians alone. There are many in Lima kneeling before the altars of the church who have their hearts with the devil. And there are Indians here who are pagans but have their hearts with God." Right. These ideas might even be extended to Africans. While there had been clerical advocates for better treatment of Africans and the need to bring them to the faith by gentle instruction, there were more radical positions as well. Mateo Salé, actually a Frenchman living in Peru, had a certain heretical proclivity, and he claimed that all the slave owners were damned, and that the Pope, who had authorized the slave trade, must have been drunk at the time. This got him into considerable trouble with the Inquisition. Or a man named Juan de Cuevas, a carpenter from Jaén in Andalusia, who lived in Cartagena de Indias in Colombia, right? In the 1620s, this was a center of the slave trade. Juan de Cuevas was a man at war with all authority. He believed that the lands of the heretics were ruled better than those of Spain. He did not believe the conversion of the Africans justified their enslavement, and he attacked slavery and the slave trade frontally. He thought that Africans could find salvation in their own way, in their own land, and that they should be allowed to live in their law, in their own lands where they were raised, and that the king does this only for his self-interest and for no other good intention. Such statements reveal an unease with social conditions and inequities and the hierarchy of the colonies. And even more, the willingness of individuals to speak out against them, and despite the weight of theology and political authority, to speak out forcefully. Racial divisions in some ways undercut the millennial promise of America. And there were people who objected to those racial divisions. In 1601, the chaplain of a convent in Puebla, Mexico, gave an apocalyptic warning. After the East and West Indies and Guinea, Africa, were discovered, the nations have become mixed, but they have not conformed or united with each other as the prophet Daniel called for. And this can be seen because they call each other Indian dog, mulatto dog, mestizo dog, and so they remain in discord amongst themselves. And thus, we must await that which will come. In other words, an apocalyptic warning. By the 18th century, these popular ideas of religious tolerance continued to be expressed. But now they were joined by a rising chorus of more systematized arguments coming from elsewhere in Europe. We're all familiar with the story. Publications like Locke's Letter on Toleration of 1689, or Voltaire's Letters from England, 1626. Voltaire, remember, is the one who said that the English were great because they had many religions, right? And nobody cared what your religion was as long as you made money, right? Voltaire, however, added with a certain Gallic condensation that England was a great place. It had many religions, but unfortunately, only one sauce. Well, those kinds of publications began to synthesize the ideas of toleration and to make toleration a civil right. They and the latter philosophers were far less interested in religion and truth as they were interested in a practical support for civil society and that religion should provide an ethical compass. Their ideas penetrated Iberia as well. In Spain, there was a noticeable shift in Inquisition prosecutions in which those accused of these relativist or universalist propositions tended now to become persons of education, some of them of social projection, lawyers and merchants and clerics, military officers and city tradesmen. Most of these were traditional ideas that have been around for centuries, however, like those expressed by one man who told the inquisitors, since the majority of people are infidels and we Catholics are so few, if the former are condemned for their religion, then God must be a tyrant who enjoys condemning them to make so many pagans and so few. By this time, however, the Inquisition was now linking theological questions with political ones. Censoring publications, limiting the circulation of books, and seeking to stem the tide of its old enemies who now had new names. The Inquisition called them encyclopedists, libertines, free thinkers, freemasons, indifferentists, and tolerationists. These were the purveyors of the poisonous doctrines of liberty, independence, and toleration. Those are the words of the inquisitors. Tolerationism, or indifferentism, became the symbols of a new age, an age of secularism that was defined as a direct attack on the real religion. But the inquisitors and those who supported the old regime if they had looked carefully at their own records, they could have seen that there had been a long tradition of such ideas amongst all sorts of people. For those persons who hoped to transform the society of Spain and Portugal, like the French and English were doing, intolerance and Inquisition became the symbols, the watchwords of exactly the kind of change they hoped to institute. But that change came very slowly. In the 19th century in most of Latin America, and not until the 20th century, did full freedom of religion become the law in Spain and Portugal. So let me return to my original question of how to deal with these obscure people in the past as actors in the historical process. One way has been through microhistory, as Carlo Ginzburg did in his wonderful study called The Cheese and the Worms. This approach raises the questions of typicality. Aldama, who we talked about at the beginning of this talk, or Minocchio, Carlo Ginzburg's protagonist in his microhistory, what do they represent? Are they representatives of popular thoughts and attitudes, or are they just a couple of idiosyncratic cranks who regularly represent nothing but themselves? How do you tell the difference? Such a question reveals the usual underlying assumption that common people in the past are only worthy of our study if they represent something, that is, if they're like everybody else. This seems to me to be prejudicial about common people. We study Erasmus and Luther and Spinoza not because they're like everybody else, but for exactly the opposite reason, because they're not like everybody else. And what I'm suggesting is that sometimes there's documentation, enough of it to exist, too, out of the individual histories of these common people to piece together and begin to reconstruct the thinking, a more general thinking, and to see these obscure men and women in the past as the purveyors, the originators of ideas, not simply their recipients. I tried to do this in my book, All Can Be Saved, with a series of sort of connected microhistories, a sort of pointillist approach that allowed me to see in their statements their vision of society, a society in which each person could be free to believe in what he or she saw fit without threat or coercion. Collectively, their doubts and tolerance provided a context for the policies of toleration that eventually developed. In some ways, by a long and winding road, their ideas were closer to our thinking today, and even to the church's position today after Vatican II, than the ideas of the inquisitors that sought to correct them. Although, as Pope Benedict has recently made clear, that issue is still theologically unsettled in the church. But still, in their way, the Iberian dissidents and their contemporaneous counterparts in the rest of Europe that can be found in many places and in the overseas extensions of Europe were, precursors of a concept of freedom of conscience that we associate today with modernity, just as much associated with it as the thinking of people who offered the coherent statements like John Locke or Roger Williams or Voltaire. These people, the commoners and the people like Voltaire and Locke, shared a common milieu. The idea of freedom of conscience and liberty did not always flow from the learned to the uneducated. In some ways, these common people, the Piers Plowmans of the past, created a soil in which the modern concepts of freedom of conscience could grow. Why they were willing to think those forbidden thoughts and sometimes speak out against what they considered to be injustice and cruelty, and why, as Peter Fritzsche showed in another historical situation, others were all too infrequently unwilling to do so, remains a challenge to us as historians, a challenge to explain. But it is also a potential challenge to each of us as individuals in our own societies to contemplate what our contemporary world should be and how tolerance and freedom of conscience are not a conquest of modernity, but something that needs to be constantly rethought and constantly re-advocated. Each of us and all of us may at some time be called on to come to the defense of toleration if we think it's something worthwhile having. Thank you very much.
Student who wants to ask the first question. Thank you for your excellent talk. It was very interesting to see the idea that that these ideas, grand ideas, come from, are also existing in the common people and arise and then create another effect of top-down. You had mentioned that these the ideas of toleration existed not only in the Spanish Peninsula, but also throughout Europe. The idea that had occurred to me was that perhaps, as you said, it was a place of three religions, that after centuries of Muslim rule in which toleration and pluralism were the norm, that it might have been a might have created this idea within the people of toleration. But you said that it existed throughout Europe, so perhaps you could shed a bit of light on this.
Well, my final chapter in the book is a sort of conclusion. It's called Rustic Pelagians. And the term Rustic Pelagians actually comes from England. After the Revolution of 1640, when the Church of England reestablished its control, many people went out into the small towns and villages in the countryside. And they wrote back to London complaining that the people out here are rustic Pelagians. That is, they don't care what religion, what church their neighbor goes to, so long as he keeps their his pigs out of their garden. All right. It was a sort of very practical kind of thinking. And there are a number of doctrinal tracts that are published that are sort of complaining about this business of indifferentism or relativism, that people, they don't care enough about what church their neighbor goes to. In the case of France, there's a lot of evidence, and in the last few years, a number of French scholars have been working on this. There are evidence of small towns in France, for example, where the town is too poor to afford a bell for the church, and so the Christian, the Catholics and the Protestants collaborate in the purchase of a bell together, or where they share the same building. Right. And so there's a lot of evidence like this. And so I looked in that final chapter in a very brief way at Italy, France, and England as just three possible examples of this. And there are a number of scholars now working on other places of Europe. When I gave a talk in Holland a number of years ago at a conference about toleration, there were a number of scholars from the Balkans who were there, who said, well, what you're describing sounds to us like the Balkans, where you had Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, Jews and Muslims all living together. And sometimes the relationships were hostile and could be hostile, but there were often long periods of a sort of live in and let live. So that's why I think that there's room here to think about this in terms of a broader concept. But the problem is, in early modern history, so much of that history we have written in the last century or so has been in terms of religious difference. The wars of religion were so important. And so a lot of it in this kind of confessionalization, the division of Europe into two confessional camps, has really been the driving force in a lot of the historiography. And no one's paid much attention to this kind of stuff that lays beneath the surface. And that was the suggestion I make, not a conclusion, but a suggestion at the end of the book, and an attempt to tie the history of Spain and Portugal, which are often kind of left aside, back into the history of a more general European history.
Yeah. Although few would disagree with your conclusion that one has to constantly defend tolerance and freedom, I would suggest that your thesis is really a two-edged sword, because all large societies have its inherence following a range of belief, and I would suggest that it is that middle group that you're talking about that acts as a swing vote. And just as they provide the groundwork for liberalism and democracy, they also provide the groundwork for dictatorship and genocide. And so, as many scholars have argued, the ideological roots of both totalitarianism and democracy go back to Rousseau, for example. And if we use American history as an example, originally slavery was allowed, Then it was banned, but then the free Negroes were mistreated. And the question of racism still exists as a problem in the United States, which is supposed to be the world's leading democracy. So the question is, it works both ways. And my question to you, therefore, is how can one load the dice to make sure that right. in this balance of going from one extreme to the other, we try to increase the odds of it following on the sure. appropriate side?
Well, I think the question is absolutely appropriate and right on. And so what always bothered me is that the same people that were expressing these ideas of toleration are the people, they're from the same social categories, let's say, of the people who would be at the auto de fe and stoning the people that would come up on the platform. And so what's the rule, what's then the role of leadership? What's the role of the institutions in the society? In the 15th century Spain, when there are the equivalent of these pogroms that take place and the forced conversion of the Jews, it's never very far that there is a fanatic preacher that's just given a sermon that incites the mob in this direction. And so it leaves open that question about the role of institutions and the role of leadership because the Balkans is another example of you can have, this can be in a kind of balance and stasis, or it can be pushed in quite a different direction. And I think that's something I don't have an answer for, but it's a problematic position, and it's something that's concerned the political scientists for a long time, looking for the origins of democracy in an authoritarian government.
Yeah. I would like to bring this session to a close by calling upon Catherine Ulmer, who is a Kundal History Fellow in the Department of History, to thank our speaker.
Well, I would just like to thank you for that fascinating and very interesting lecture. And on behalf of the audience, I'd like to present you with this talk.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to return here, and been a pleasure to speak with you, to meet the winners of this year, and I wish you every success with the continuation of the Kundal Awards.
Great, thanks.
Thanks a lot, sir.
Thank you again, Stuart, and thank you all for being with us. Just let me say a couple more things. These sessions were recorded and will be available in a few days on the Kundal Prize website, so you'll be able to view them. And I look forward to seeing everyone here again about a year from now when Lisa Jardine comes and gives the Kundal Lecture. And there will be information about the 2010 Kundal International Prize and Lecture on the website as of the new year. And one last thing, since this is Montreal and it's Monday, cocktails are already served in the room next, so please join us for a refreshment. Thank you all again. Thank you.